Log Talk Radio.
Powerful Patients on VoiceGraph, and I'm excited to have you with me today. Today we're going to talk about something we all experience from time to time, and that is the flu. So, and I have a little bit of a cold today, so if you hear that in my voice, it's appropriate for the show, right? I do this special for the show. In any event, this show is from this week by the HTML Family Alliance, the Augustine and the show is designed to be entered to people with complex medical disabilities. Of course, this affects everybody. If not, you have a complex medical condition. Of course, you do. So, let me tell you a little bit of information about VHL, and then we'll talk with our guest.
Von Hippel-Lindau disease, or VHL, is a genetic condition involving abnormal growth of tumors in some parts of the body. VHL occurs in every ethnic group worldwide. At this time, there's no cure, but research is helping those afflicted and their families learn how to manage their disease. When a family member has a tumor, it affects everyone in the family. VHL Alliance works to improve diagnosis, treatment, and the quality of life. Finding tumors early, getting the best treatment, and sharing information with others to help them cope is what VHL Alliance is all about. They're available to help lessen the stress of living with this lifetime chronic disease. Support the Cancer Research Fund of the VHL Alliance at VHL.org. That's Very Happy Life, VHL.org. 1-800-767-4-VHL.
And I hope that you'll check out VHL.org as well as PowerfulPatient.org, where you will find the archive of the many shows that we've done at the Powerful Patient for the last 3 years. So today I'd like to welcome our guest, welcome back to Captain.
Joyce, thank you. I appreciate you having me on the show.
Thank you for joining us. So I understand that you're one of only 18 physicians in the country who's a board-certified specialist in family medicine and pain medicine.
Yeah, the majority of pain practitioners in the country are either physical medicine and rehab specialists or anesthesiologists. Being a family physician, I think we bring, in addition to a pain specialist, I'm able to bring a broader background in the process of dealing with my patient's pain problems. So I'm also able to treat their basic physical conditions in terms of any colds or flus they have in this particular case, but if they're having problems with chronic asthma, problems with sleep disorders, problems with family issues, psychological problems that may be impacting their pain and disability disorders, all of this comes into play, and as a family practitioner, it gives me a little bit different background and the scope of practice on this than some of the other practitioners who deal with chronic pain.
Very interesting. So you have a Center for Integrative Medicine. Tell us what integrative medicine is.
Integrative medicine is about taking the best practices from a variety of medical systems, so such as acupuncture, such as homeopathy, manual medicine therapies, and combining them with conventional Western medical practices to end up with really what I believe is best medicine practices overall. So it's not about doing something instead of Western medicine, but it's rather having the ability to combine all of these different medical approaches so that you end up with a better diagnosis and a better treatment plan for your patient.
Interesting. I mean, there are a lot of physicians who think that if you use acupuncture that you're rejecting Western medicine. And I'm with you. I like to add a little acupuncture on top of the Western medicine patients I get.
I think one of the powers of doing an integrative approach is that you can, in many cases, decrease the amount of medications that are necessary for treating an issue. You can, in some cases, eliminate the need for medications by utilizing acupuncture. it makes more sense to be taking nutritional approaches in some cases than necessarily medication approaches. There are people who have side effects from a variety of medications that we can address with some nutritional approaches. And one of the interesting things that's shown up in one study is that people who have elevated cholesterol and were having side effects from the statin medications were found to have low vitamin D levels. And in a number of those patients, when the vitamin D levels were restored to normal levels, their side effects from the statin medications went away. So it's about combining the best of a whole series of different medicines to get the best possible outcome, but you end up with optimal health.
Sounds great. Yeah, and I think vitamin D is chronically low in most Americans these days because we're spending so much more time indoors.
Our experience with vitamin D is that about 80% of our patient population is abnormally low, deficient in vitamin D. We measure it on a regular basis in our patients, and we watch it very closely. We believe that the normative levels of vitamin D should be in the range of about 50 to 100 nanograms per deciliter. The recent study that came out from the Institute of Medicine suggested that 30 to 50 was probably an adequate range. I think the studies support pushing a little bit higher than that, but at least being at 30 is an absolute minimum requirement. And when your vitamin D's are low, you're much more susceptible to developing colds and flus. We know that the vitamin D is very important in functioning of the innate immune system, and there are some good studies demonstrating that in school children who have been supplemented with vitamin D, there was a much lower rate of flu when their vitamin D levels were brought up to normal levels than in those that had not. And your point about spending so much time indoors is exactly correct in terms of why we're also deficient in vitamin D. But the other thing is when we go outside, we're using so much sunblock that we're preventing ourselves from making vitamin D. And vitamin D is normally made by sun interacting with chemicals in our skin. And with the sunblock on, that process is interfered with or stopped completely, depending upon how high an SPF factor we're using. And so we end up typically, in northern hemispheres at least, most of us are deficient in vitamin D.
Yeah, that has become pretty controversial these days because there's a professor here in Boston who's recommending you spend 20 minutes in the sunshine each day, and some of his colleagues are all up in arms against him because they say he's promoting skin cancer. But we do need some sunshine, and as you said, we need to get our vitamin D, either making it ourselves or taking it by mouth, one way or another.
It's been suggested that you need about 20 minutes of sun exposure, bare arms, legs, neck, and head a day in order to produce adequate vitamin D levels. And you're right, there is potentially an increased risk of developing skin cancers as a result of chronic overexposure to the sun. But 20 minutes a day is not, I think, an excessive amount of sun exposure. And I think it also helps in terms of our psychological health to be able to get out in the sun and get some bright sunlight into our eyes, which also helps in terms of setting our clocks so that we can sleep better, and it also internal clocks, and it also helps in terms of our mood. So sunlight is important to getting, and we don't get enough of it. The sunlight coming to us through windows is inadequate because most of the wavelengths of the sun necessary for us to produce vitamin D are all screened out. So you really need to be outside with some level of direct exposure.
Right, and not to overdo that. I mean, getting yourself broiled is definitely a bad idea, but having some modest amount of sunshine is really good for us.
You're absolutely correct. I mean, you want to monitor everything in moderation is really what it comes down to. But the real way to find out if you've got adequate levels of vitamin D is to measure it. It's a simple blood test. And I think that pretty much every physician should be screening for vitamin D. We know that it has effects on the immune system, but we also know that low vitamin D levels can lead to generalized muscle pain. We know that low vitamin D levels lead to fatigue. And so measuring vitamin D is as easy as measuring a blood count and fairly inexpensive and should be part of a normal physical exam.
Right. Nobody had ever mentioned this to me before. About last year, the nurse practitioner practitioner in my doctor's office said, oh, and we should check your vitamin D. And I thought, okay. And it came back very low, and she put me on vitamin D meds. And here I take multivitamins, and I consider myself reasonably healthy. And so it was a real surprise to me that vitamin D level came back so low. There's been a lot in the press about it lately, that something we all should be.
The other thing that we tend to do with vitamin D is we can give you a prescription form of vitamin D2, and typically that dose is about 50,000 international units once a week in order to bring your levels back up. But frankly, we prefer to give you a simple supplement of vitamin D3, which is the form that's active in the body, and that you can buy over the counter. And you take, and again, it's best to have your levels measured, but I personally take 5,000 international units a day during the winter to keep my vitamin D levels up. Again, I periodically measure it to make sure that I'm staying in the safe range. But frankly, at 5,000 a day, I've not run into any toxicity with myself or with my patients.
Very interesting. So part of what we're trying to do, and vitamin D, of course, is part of the picture, is keeping our immune systems operating at peak performance, right? What else contributes to keeping your immune system strong so your own natural defenses are working for you?
Well, it's very important that you're getting adequate sleep. Sleep is kind of the cornerstone of everything that we need in order to stay healthy. And adequate sleep is defined as somewhere between 7 to 9 hours a night of uninterrupted sleep. So sleep is extremely important in terms of normal immune functioning and staying healthy. Exercise, another very important thing to be doing for optimizing our immune functioning, and you should be getting at least 20 minutes, preferably 30 minutes of good aerobic exercise 3 to 4 times a week in order to have optimal immune functioning. And good aerobic exercise is defined as getting your heart rate up to a rate which is 220 minus your age, and you take 60% and 80% of that number, and that will give you a good range that you're aiming for aerobic workout. The catch on that is if you're on any particular medications, you need to talk to your physician about that first, because certain heart medications such as beta blockers will prevent you from getting into that range. For most average individuals, working to move into an aerobic range for 20 to 30 minutes at least 3 times a week will help optimize the functioning of your immune system. During the winter and actually all year long, lots of hand washing. One of the simplest, easiest ways to prevent the spread of disease is keeping your hands clean. And so washing your hands on a regular basis and then not touching your face with your hands, because germs easily get picked up on doorknobs and when you're in public places. And so, and shaking hands for that matter. And so washing your hands on a regular basis is very effective. And obviously in a medical office, we make sure we wash our hands in between each patient encounter so we're not carrying any germs back and forth.
One of the things that was keeping me from washing my hands for a long time was the soap they put in the bathroom door. It's very drying to your hands. What do you recommend for people that have that kind of chapped hands problem?
Simple moisturizing fluid carrying with you is probably the best thing to be doing, carrying a small bottle of that. I'm not real crazy about all the antiseptic washes that people are utilizing. I think that long term we're going to create some problems with the Purell and all of that stuff, because I think we're super sanitizing ourselves. So light hand washing with cool water will probably help if you're having problems with lots of chapping, and some hand moisturizer should take care of the problem.
So super sanitizing is not a good idea. Talk a little about that.
I'm sorry, I missed a question.
Well, you said super sanitizing, and I know there's been a lot in the press about are we doing ourselves good or ill by having all these antiseptic washes for the surfaces in the kitchen or for the soaps in the bathroom and so forth.
Yeah, I think we need a certain amount of exposure to some level of germs in order for our immune systems to be able to learn what they are and build up proper antibody protection against them. It's why we give flu shots. And flu shots, by the way, I think is another very important tool in helping prevent the occurrence of flu and disease. You know, flu is a very serious disease, and about 5 to 20% of the American public develops flu in any given flu season. And we see a number of people who die as a result of flu. So getting a flu shot every year, I do myself. I recommend it for all of my patients, and especially for any patients who have any kind of chronic illness, chronic disease. I think the flu shot is really essential. So that would be another way in order to help keep yourself healthy during the winter. Getting back to your question, though, about the hand washing, you know, we're using Purell. They're even embedding some of these sanitizers into socks in order to prevent odors from occurring. And we're starting to absorb this stuff into our skins, and no one really understands what the consequences of that may be. And I'm not interested in being an experiment on these things. So I think that normal precautions in terms of hand washing, but constantly using Purell, constantly using these other hand sanitizers, and having this stuff embedded in our clothing is not a good idea.
Good point. Yeah. So let's talk about the flu a little bit. Some people say, oh, it's just a cold. Is the flu the same thing as a cold, or is it different?
It's a different virus. Colds and flus are both viruses. However, the flu virus is a very specific type of virus, and actually there's several types of viruses that constitute the flu virus. Flus are a much more dramatic disease typically than colds, and so what you see with the flu is it comes on very quickly. Typically run high fevers being defined as being 101 or higher. And then depending upon where the flu hits, if it's more upper respiratory flu, you're going to have a cough, and it can potentially go into a pneumonia. If it's a gastrointestinal flu, then it's going to hit the GI tract, and then you'll have problems with nausea, vomiting, and diarrhea. And it's a very intense illness. You typically have hard, shaking chills. And if you've ever had the flu, you know it's a very unique experience from a cold and a truly miserable experience. Flus typically last about 3-4 days and they're gone, but they can, in the process, because of the high fevers and because of the severity of the immune response in order to fight it off, you feel pretty crummy and wiped out for a couple of days after a flu. Colds, on the other hand, much milder, typically an adenovirus. You can have a sore throat, scratchy throat. You typically have more of a runny nose. Fevers not so high. Fevers typically maybe about 99, you feel run down and uncomfortable. You may have generalized aches and pains, not of the level of intensity that you'll see with a flu, where you've got really bad muscle aches and joint pains, but a milder form of that with the cold. And the colds typically run a course of about 7 days.
Right, and I had the Hong Kong flu in the 1960s. The first dramatic flu of my lifetime, and I was flat on my back for a week, which I never am. So that was a very memorable experience for me.
Flus are miserable experiences, and just from a conventional standpoint, if you develop the flu, there are actually a medication called Tamiflu, which when utilized within the first 24-48 hours of the onset of the flu, can dramatically shorten the occurrence of a flu specifically. Colds, not going to do anything for. But for a flu, that's a conventional medication that can be very effective in helping you get back on your feet and decreasing the severity of the disease.
Right.
And as I said, yeah.
When you first get it, you probably wouldn't know the difference between a cold or a flu. But so taking the Tamiflu, if it's not really the flu, is not a problem?
It's not a problem, but it's not going to be useful. You will typically know the difference between a flu and a cold. Flus come on very fast, and they hit very hard with high fevers and chills and generalized body pain. Colds come on much slower. The symptoms are much milder than a true flu. So there really is a distinction in terms of the severity of the symptoms and how high your fever is going to be running between a cold and a flu.
There's been a backlash against a number of different kinds of vaccines and things lately, and I saw that there's some 20-something guy who has actually written a pop song about why you should not get the flu shot. So tell us what your thoughts are on that. I see you're recommending the flu shot, and I agree with you. But why should people not listen to that?
I think it's really a matter of listening to the evidence and looking at the studies and seeing the fact that the flu shot is safe and it is effective. Basically, it decreases your chance of getting the flu by about 80%. So there's still a percentage of people who will still get flu even though they got the shot, but the severity of the flu will be much less so in those individuals. The flu shot saves lives. I mean, it's really a function of looking at the literature, looking at the science, and saying this is what makes sense in order to keep myself safe and healthy during the winter.
We forget so quickly how severe these diseases can be. My mother is one of the survivors of the 1918 flu, but that took, what, 10% of the world's population died of flu that year?
Millions and millions of people died from that flu. You're absolutely correct.
Wow. So who's the most vulnerable? If there were some small number of populations, who would you say these should be the first ones to get?
Small children and older adults are really the highest risk in terms of developing complications from the flu that may be fatal. And so those are the populations we focus on first in order to get them vaccinated. Anybody with chronic illness such as heart disease, any kind of immunologic problem or cancer, those people are on medications which suppress the immune system. Those people in particular are at a much higher risk, and so we want to make sure we get them vaccinated first. Pretty much anybody over 65 gets put on the high priority list for getting vaccination. But frankly, I would vaccinate pretty much everybody.
Is there anybody that should not get vaccinated? I mean, there are some contraindications, as they say in the trade.
You know, if you've had problems with previous allergic reactions to the flu, ideally thimerosal is one component that we use to stabilize the flu vaccine and its mercury compound. There's some debate as to whether or not it's a good idea to be injecting homeopathic mercury into people. And so if you can get a preservative-free flu shot, certainly in children, we don't use thimerosal. If you're allergic to eggs, that would be a contraindication for the flu since it's prepared in egg culture. If you've had a history of certain neurologic diseases such as Guillain-Barré, that would be a contraindication for a flu shot. But basically, if you discuss this with your physician, they'll be able to tell you whether or not you're a candidate or not. There's only a small number of people who are not good candidates for getting the flu shot.
Right, and I work the flu clinic in my local town here every year, and we do vaccinate people from infancy up into well into the 90s. So I agree with you. I have my own experiences that very few people have a problem with the vaccine. Right. So keeping your immune system strong, taking vitamins and making sure that all of our complements and vitamins are strong is important. How does one get tested? You mentioned a test for vitamin D. Are there other tests for vitamin levels and so forth that we ought to get to make sure that we're really healthy? Because these are things that most GPs really don't do.
Well, as far as general health is concerned, or looking specifically, rather, at prevention of colds and flus, a general physical exam is fine, but you're right, fairly insensitive. Checking for other vitamins, you know, we're not entirely certain what the normative level should be for all of these things. So I think generally checking for instance, for vitamin C levels or vitamin E levels mineral levels such as zinc, are not necessarily going to tell us whether or not it's helping us stay healthy or not, because we're unclear. The studies aren't out there. There are some studies that suggest that vitamin C may be helpful in the prevention of colds and flus, and there's a couple of studies that looked at people who were exposed to environmental stressors or psychological stressors, and found that they found in those individuals that there was about a 50% reduction in the occurrence of colds in these individuals. And these were studies done in the military, particularly where they were stationed in the Antarctic. so they were under extreme environmental stress. But the studies are not conclusive across the board, and no one's clear exactly what the dose should be of vitamin C. As a rule, I suggest to my patients that they take about 500 milligrams of vitamin C three times a day, and that's on the low end. Comfortably 1,000 milligrams a day, 1,000 milligrams three times a day, I think helps maintain adequate vitamin C levels in you. It's a water-soluble vitamin, so it will pass through you as opposed to accumulating in you like a fat-soluble vitamin, which vitamin D is. And so there's really not going to get toxic from C. But the side effect you could potentially run into is gastrointestinal irritation, and that will start to develop diarrhea. Certainly 3,000 a day is a very safe level and one in which we typically don't see problems in adults with diarrhea or other side effects from the vitamin C.
So vitamin C has been shown to be very helpful in boosting our immune systems for many, many reasons. And so it's always a good idea to do that. And it is something that you don't get enough of if you just take a multivitamin, right?
As a rule, and you have to be careful about the multivitamins that you're taking. Indeed, you need to be careful about any supplement that you're taking. The thing about supplements is that they are not regulated by anybody. So since they're not regulated, it means that there's nobody who's really checked to make sure that what's in that pill that you're taking has in it what it says it has in it. So and there's been studies that have looked at vitamin D, for instance, supplements, and they have found ranges of, from pill to pill in a bottle that says it has 400 international units, they found ranges within that single bottle in different pills, some that had 200 international units, some that had as many as 10,000 international units. So you want, and there are other studies looking at DHEA, another supplement that's not specifically used for colds and flus, where nothing has been found in the pills. There are also whether or not the binding agents that get used in them are preventing you from absorbing it. And there was a study a number of years ago with one popular multivitamin that the way they determined if people were taking the multivitamin is they counted the number of multivitamins that came out in the stool, because they simply weren't breaking down in the digestive tract. So you need to make sure that you're taking a high quality supplement, and you need to know a little bit about the manufacturer, so that you know that the process that they've gone through actually delivers the supplement that you're taking and gets it into your body in the dosages that it says it's getting it into, and that there aren't any other side contaminants.
And that's a lot for a consumer to try to learn. So is there a relatively easy way for a consumer to figure that out? Is there a website reliable or something like that?
There are a number of different websites coming off the top of my head. I'm afraid I'm not going to be able to pull anything off the very top of my head, but looking at consumer websites trying to get some idea about the quality of the product, generally I would not go to the website of the people who are selling you the product.
Right.
Unless you're prepared to look through their manufacturing processes. So look at whether or not they have standard operating procedures, what their testing procedures are, and whether or not they also check afterwards to see what the shelf life is of the medication. So whether in 6 months, 1 year, 2 years, in fact, the medication is still useful to you.
Is there any kind of a logo or a seal of approval that one manufacturer might have earned over another one that's worth looking at?
There's supposedly a thing called the Good Manufacturing Standards. However, Good Manufacturing Standards, there's I think three or four or perhaps as many as six different organizations that issue that seal, and you have to know which organization issued the seal to know whether or not anybody it actually has any meaning. One source is the Natural Medicine Comprehensive Database. So Natural Medicine Comprehensive Database is actually evidence-based data on herbs and various supplements, and they've done a really excellent job. I think it's probably the best site on the web in order to get information on this. So that's called Natural Medicine Comprehensive Database.
Okay.
I don't have their email address, but you can look that up. And that's an independent source, and it's not funded by any of the manufacturers. And they've done a thorough job of looking at most of the supplements that are out there and looking at the level of evidence as to the efficacy of the supplements.
Great. I noticed in your list that you sent around before the interview that one of the ways to cure the flu is to stay warm and laugh often. Great time to watch the old comedy, Central Blanket. Tell us why that's helpful.
Absolutely. Laughter actually improves the functioning of your immune system. It improves the number of T helper cells, and so it ramps up the body in order. The body feels, you know, when the body feels good and the body is happy, your immune system is happy. When the body is depressed and you're feeling depressed, the fact of the matter is your immune system is depressed as well. So laughter is a wonderful way to help keep yourself healthy and keep your immune system functioning optimally.
That's great. That's great. Now, if someone is looking for a physician of your mindset, integrative medicine, how does one find a physician who's working with integrative medicine in their own area? Is there
an excellent question. Typically, members of the American Holistic Medical Association would be a good place to start looking at their website. There's a website for the academic consortium of integrative medicine. Let me see if I can pull that up for you. It's Consortium of Academic Health Centers for Integrative Medicine. CAHCIM at UMN.edu. That's a website which is a consortium of university academic centers around the country who are doing research and training in integrative medicine. And so that's another good source of information.
CAHCIM,
Consortium Academic Health Centers Integrative Medicine.
Great. Thank you so much. Well, this has been really great. Is there anything else that you'd like to leave our listeners with before we finish it?
Well, there's a couple of things we didn't get to talk about in terms of treatment. And one of the things on treatment would be a thing called OMCA, U-M-C-K-A. OMCA is an herb from a South African geranium. It's the root of that particular herb. And that we have found to be very effective in terms of reducing the number of days that you're suffering with a cold or a flu. There's also a couple of homeopathic products, one of which is acylococcinium. Acylococcinium has got a couple of small studies demonstrating its effectiveness for treatment of flu, and those are all available over the counter. Engestol, E-N-G-E-S-T-O-L, no R, Engestol, is available also over the counter as a homeopathic that can be used for treatment of an acute cold or flu. There's a number of Chinese herbs that we also make use of, but that you need to be talking to your healthcare practitioner. But the smell invasion is one herb that we use from a company called Khan that's been extremely effective for helping people get over colds and flus faster. The caveat with the OMCA and the things like the smell invasion is that if people have problems with autoimmune diseases such as lupus or rheumatoid arthritis, you don't want to be using these kind of preparations because they can actually flare up your autoimmune condition. So anybody with lupus, anybody with rheumatoid arthritis, anybody with mixed connective tissue disease, anybody with multiple sclerosis should stay away from products such as OMCA or dispel invasion, anything that'll increase the functioning of the immune system, because that may make the symptoms worse.
Right. And we'll have the complete list in the handout that goes with this show on powerfulconsultation.org, and so you can report there as well. Great. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Kaplan. It's been so much to talk with you today, and I really appreciate you joining us.
Well, thank you very much, and I enjoyed being on the show.
And your own website is www.kaplanclinic.com, K-A-P-L-A-N clinic.com. Is that right?
That's correct.
Great. So if anybody is close to McLean, Virginia, you might want to check out the Kaplan Center for Integrative Medicine. And thank you so much, Dr. Kaplan, for being with us. And thanks, everybody, for joining us today. And we hope that you'll be with us again next week. So be well and be a powerful patient. Thanks.